So far, we've had no problems from most people.
I think it was just the fact that it wasn't the right Chris Hemsworth.
He doesn't sound Australian at all.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 78, recorded live Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. I am Joel Duggan, and to my right, returning, is Mr. Peyton Francis of Cardboard Treehouse. Peyton, what is going on, man?
Hey, long-lost friends. How is everyone doing tonight?
It has been a while, sir.
Yeah, you know, work and life and work and life and life.
Well, we had some life over the weekend, which was nice.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I will get into that in just a second. But joining us this evening is Mr. Chris Hemsworth. No, not the actor. It's not Thor. It's the graphic designer and the artist. And I guess the, what did you say? It was somewhat dormant Last Words webcomic.
Yeah.
Taking a bit of a break.
You and I have had talks about this before, but there hasn't been an update for a while, you know, but it's still, you know, it's something I work on, and
well,
it's there.
That's the nature of webcomics, man. I mean, you work on them when you can. They're, you know, usually subsidized by other things, so that's how it rolls. But welcome to the show, man. It's good to finally have you on.
Yeah. No, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks, guys, for inviting me on, and I'm pretty sure we probably lost half of the listenership, is that a word, when you said that I'm not the actor Chris Hemsworth. Everybody was like, wait a minute.
Well, it's funny because when I was plugging this on Twitter earlier, I was like, and my buddy Chris Hemsworth is going to be here. And I thought, no, I can't do that because the internet will have a cow.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you guys that actually I get, and this is not a joke, I get about 6 new followers on Twitter a day just because they think that I'm the actor guy.
How many of them are 23-year-old co-eds?
All of them. And also, I feel like some of them are robots, possibly.
Oh, probably porn bots.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have that problem. I have the invisible egg problem. I'll mention something about technology or art or something related to comics, and then I'll get these robot thing following me, and they're just spam bots that don't even bother to have a picture of a cute girl. They're just eggs. They're just the default Twitter egg. I'm just like, god damn it.
Yep.
At least give me something pretty to look at before I delete you 5 seconds later. Come on.
Exactly. You know? Oh, I don't delete them. I'll take what I get.
That's what a serial killer says, right? Yeah. Give me something pretty to look at before I get rid of it. It puts the lotion on its skin.
Oh, man. Well, if you listener are new to the Citadel Cafe, this is where myself and my friends come to hang out and talk about the things that we are into. We gravitate towards geeky sci-fi stuff, but we're not myopic. If it's a website, if it is a book or a television show or movie, we'll certainly let you know if we think it's cool. We will also let you know if we think it's crap, which is actually part of the fun. So, one of the things that I wanted to sidebar into before we go any further is that, Chris, you and I have been friends for about a year. I think we met at HellCon last year.
It's
been that long. I mean, it's your first time on the show. I wanted you to give, have an opportunity to tell everybody what it is that you do.
Sure. Yeah.
I do stuff.
I guess I'm a graphic... I'm a graphic designer. I've been thinking about that. Like, I think I prefer to think of it as like graphic artist because I don't know. It's kind of weird to get into the semantics of it. But
well, when people think graphic design, they think, you know, advertisements and text logos and stuff like that. And you do a lot of illustration as well.
Well, yeah, there's like a fusion, I guess, a little bit of illustration into there. But like, you know, for me, I'm kind of that weird zone where I think you made the comment one time when you said, like, looking at Last Word stuff, for example, that it sort of leans a bit more toward the designy look than it does the illustrative look. Like, you guys are, you know, hardcore illustrators where you've got like great line control and all that stuff. Whereas my stuff is kind of, you know what I mean? Like, it kind of falls into a graphic design style of illustration, I guess. Do you know what I mean? Like,
well, yeah, I would say the final image, like the polish that you put on it, probably has that design feel to it. But I mean, I wouldn't say that, you know, there's any less line control, because I mean, a line is just a graphic with two sides, right?
My trick is
I don't get semantic about stuff.
Yeah, my trick is I don't use any lines. That's how I.
Right.
I'm just kidding. That's what I do. I guess my day job is I work for myself. I'm a graphic designer, illustrator guy. I started doing it seriously, I guess maybe about, I guess only like 4 years ago. It was a slow build. I came from a music background and transitioned. I'd always been doing sort of illustrative stuff and design and poster stuff on the side when I was in university for music. And then it just was one of those things where it hit me like, I love music. Like I'm a classically trained guitarist, but I don't want to do that with my life. You know what I mean? So it's one of those epiphany things. And then I just started slowly trying to, you know, get going doing this graphic design stuff on my own. But it was a slow build, and I had to do guitar lessons on the side and everything to sort of facilitate that. But I look at it as like it's just still going. Like I'm still just sort of trying to keep pushing forward and constantly learning all that stuff. That's pretty much me, man. That's pretty much where I'm at.
Cool. And where can people find your work?
Oh, right. Well, the best place is probably just ChristopherHemsworth.ca, or sorry, .com. Actually, either one will take you to the same place, but ChristopherHemsworth.com will have all of the links to everything, basically. My portfolio is there, links to all my social media, all that stuff. Right now, it's just a temporary website that's sort of being powered by Behance, so I'm working on like a full-fledged, legit, fun looking website, and that's pretty much it.
Cool. Any particular projects that you've been working on lately that have deserved some media attention?
Well, I mean, probably the biggest, coolest thing is the Heritage Minutes poster series, which you and I have talked pretty extensively about on our hangout times. But that's going along finally, pretty full steam right now. It was kind of one of those weird things. Like it started as a passion project, and it was just a thing. Like I said, you know what? I love these minutes. Like maybe I could just do like an iconic poster series of these somehow. I did the first one, which was the Vince Coleman Halifax Explosion one. You know, I've got to save the people on that train.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, and I sort of put it out onto the internet. And then what happened was they caught wind of it at Historica Dominion, which is actually changing now to be Historica Canada. And they caught wind of it and said, hey, we love this. Would you want to, you know, can we commission a series from you? And so, of course, I was like, wow, that's really great. Yeah, I'd love to do that. So what ended up happening is they said, well, here's the deal. We did a survey across Canada. We figured out like a really like hardcore extensive survey where they brought in like a third party and found all this research and statistics. But basically they determined the top 10 favorite minutes from across Canada. So then they said, how about those? Like we'll do like a limited edition series of 10 that will be those. So, you know, it's all sort of the ones that we probably most know, like the basketball one, the Superman one, mm-hmm. John McRae, Laura Secord. So I won't list them all, but anyway. But the weird thing that happened was that they also had these two brand new minutes one was the Queenston Heights minute, and the other one is the Pierpoint minute. And so they said, you know what, can we get you to do those two also, but before the actual series of 10? So there was kind of this weird delay in actually getting rolling into sort of like the top 10 one, which are the ones that I know through and through from our childhood, you know, like seeing them on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it was kind of like this, I got those two done and finally that's sort of done. And it was really fun to do them, but now it's like getting into the real, so I just submitted the sketches for all the ideas for the rest of the remaining eight or nine, actually nine, because I'm doing 11 total for the real series, like the original series of them. Anyway, so that's me going on and on about that, but
oh,
it's
cool.
A really fun project.
Yeah, it's a really cool project.
Any chance they could they really lend themselves well to being stamps as well? So is there any talk of that?
It's funny you should say that, Peyton, because in my original proposal to them, I mocked up stamps and also trading cards so that they could just see, like, you know, we could repurpose this imagery so that, you know, like it could be repurposed for a lot of different things. But yeah, so it's funny you should say that because I did pitch that idea at them and they liked the idea. It's sort of, they said that, it's one of those things like they've got to go through Canada Post and there's like a whole bunch of hoops you have to kind of go through, I think, to get a stamp sort of commissioned or accepted, but they still like the idea, and I do too. That would be incredible. Like, I can't imagine to have like a piece of your art on a stamp. First of all, who even uses stamps anymore, right? But
all your friends would.
I'm kind of kidding, but
your mom, who misses you terribly.
Yeah.
I mean, for anybody that's not familiar, I mean, especially if you happen to be an American or international listener, the Heritage Minutes were a 1 to 3 minute live action cinematics that covered bits of Canadian history, and they would run them on CBC and I think CTV and some other Canadian television channels, like commercials, but they were just kind of like an educational historic bite. Of some important moments in Canadian history, and they were run so often that a lot of us kind of committed them to memory.
as soon as you start hearing like the hinterland one, as soon as you hear the whistle, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. Like, do you guys feel like you've quoted them through your whole life? Like, did they get ingrained in your
Prospector
mind?
Prospector said, "Bill Miner."
Yeah.
Or like you've got to get. You're going to miss that train, you know, the Superman one. I feel like there's a bunch of quotes within that one. Like, if you're not fast, you're going to miss your train. See what your cousin Frank says in Toronto. Anyway, the funny thing is that if you talk to Americans about, like, I lived in the States for about 4 years. And so that's when I first get the DVD. You can get a DVD with all the minutes on it. Now you can just get it on iTunes too, of course. But at the time, you know, DVD, and they didn't know anything about it. So like I had been quoting all of them like crazy when I was living there, and everybody looked at me like, "All right, buddy, like whatever, you like, what are you even talking about?" So I got the DVD mailed to me, and I said, "All right," and I got a couple of my friends that I had when I was living in the States, and I sat them down. And I was like, "Watch this," and I played it for them. Anyway, that was the realization of the power of nostalgia, because it surely did not have the same effect on them. Watching it at that time, and they don't have really an equivalent thing right there. And they tried to say that Schoolhouse Rocks was sort of a similar thing.
I don't know,
but it's not the same. It's not like the same kind of history and heritage, right? But anyway,
cool.
So yeah.
Well, we unplugged this weekend, and Peyton and I are probably going to share some of our what have we been up to stories, because I had a much needed break with. The cell phone was on me, but it was off most of the time. Mm-hmm. So for Labor Day weekend, Jocelyn and I went over to Peyton and Lee's to hang out for a little bit. We had a nice dinner on Sunday night, and then we spent the entire very rainy Monday holiday here with Peyton and his wife. And we went for a walk in the park.
Wow.
In the rain? Our beach umbrella, which is basically like a deck umbrella.
Yeah. Like, picture any patio table where you're like, you know, sharing beer with friends, and there's a giant umbrella to keep the sun off of you. Mm-hmm. That's what Peyton had over his shoulder.
You all laugh, but we were all dry.
It was both hilarious and practical, and you could see people walking by us laughing at Peyton and cursing him at the same time. Yeah. Yeah. Because these people were soaked.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, that's kind of brilliant, actually, to do. I mean, it'd be huge. Like, you'd be perfectly dry, right?
Well, I mean,
4 foot in diameter, so we could all stand underneath it.
Yeah.
Yeah, my wife is like, "We don't want to take that." I'm like, "We're going to take that."
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
because most times when my wife says, "We're not going to take that," is because she doesn't want to carry it. And I know she's not going to be carrying it, and I will. I'm like, "Don't worry about it. I'm the one packing the stuff around," right? So, you know.
The pack mule husband.
What about the wind? Did the wind try to, like, you know,
scoop
you
away? No, we were sheltered in the trees and stuff, but a couple points it was like a torrent coming down, and we were bone dry. Like, I was able to put it over the edge of the car, and we were all standing, like, with the door open in the car, and not a drop of rain getting in the car. And my 3-year-old thought it was hilarious, and he had his little umbrella there that he kept sticking into people and breaking and stuff. So.
I was victim.
It was nice to go in the park, and it was nice to get out of the basement, you know, cave. And
it was nice to see, I took some pictures for Painting Reference and stuff like that, just with my iPhone, but everything, I mean, it's the end of summer, so, I mean, everything is just so green, because we tend to get a lot of rain here in Halifax, but with that much rain coming down, like, every plant and every fern and tree was just super, super saturated and green. So I got some really nice pictures and stuff like that.
The light was nice and flat as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, there's lots of detail and stuff like that. And I mean, it was fun to watch you and sea squirrels and try to process what to do next.
Yes, like, you know, kill it or catch it.
Yeah.
Or run away.
Or run away. Yeah, well, one of them got really territorial because, of course, in Shubi, there's all these places where you can feed the squirrels, and there's benches that are full of seeds and stuff like that. And Ewan would, of course, go right up to the benches, and the squirrels would be just like, get away from my dinner! Mm-hmm. Get away!
That's why when I go for a walk in the woods, I always carry a driver.
Oh, Peyton, the animal lover amongst
us. You're kind of sick and twisted, Peyton, and I realize that about you. And
yeah,
I
who's really the serial killer now, bitch?
If it moves, eat it.
Yeah, if it's too dumb to run away. See, squirrels are pretty smart. They're a lot faster than people. Cows, not so much.
Although there's a great trick if you're ever stuck in the woods for catching squirrels, is you put a stick on about a 45-degree angle from the ground to the tree, and you put a snare from the three snares on the stick going from the bottom, circling over the top like a number nine. And the squirrel runs up and then gets caught and hangs itself. And then the next squirrel runs up, gets caught, and hangs itself on the next one. And then you got enough for a stew after you get three or four of them. So
I'm starting to get the feeling that you legit have actually caught and eaten squirrels.
No, I've never eaten a squirrel, no.
Oh, okay. No. You had me thinking you did.
Newfoundlanders just know this stuff.
Oh, okay.
Well, survival training and all that stuff, when you're a kid.
When you have to grow up to be a zombie killer.
I've shot them with 12 gauges,
What's
it's
left?
It's hard to farm them after. Anyway, we won't get into that.
No, but I'm a little sad that that summer's over. I mean, I'm usually at this point of the year, I'm just exhausted from my apartment being 8,000 degrees, but I've had an air conditioner this year, so I am a little bummed that things are going to start to get rainy and cold and, for all intents and purposes, miserable in Halifax for the next couple of months until it starts to snow and it becomes a little bit cleaner. What are you guys? How did you guys finish off your summer? Was it just as big of a blur as mine?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I feel like that's sort of my thought was like, where did August go? Which I feel like an old person, where did the summer go? But it's like, it just honestly, like, I feel like suddenly it's September, right? Do you guys feel like that? Like all of a sudden?
Yeah, I feel like it's all of a sudden, but I also, I mean, you guys probably, it's probably all of our years going to school, but I always feel more productive this time of year.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, it's like kicking into like sort of for some reason when September hits, it's like everybody's, back to university, back to school, back to some kind of like concrete routines. The vacation times are over. Clients actually get back to me about stuff. it's better in a lot of ways.
Yeah, vacations are all over.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that was a weird, I found the summer was weird for vacations. I feel like everybody was taking a lot of vacation time except me. Because, working for yourself, what are you
going
to do?
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of that going on. But, not a whole lot of that going on. Well, I guess we can move into the movies, TV, and videos section of the show. And I can kick it off with a mellow pick. I was hanging out with Jocelyn on Monday night, and we were trying to figure out what to do just to kind of relax and finish off the weekend before she had to go back to work the next day. And I was just like, you know what, ladies pick. Like, I'm in the mood for just about anything. If you want to sit down and watch a movie or play video games or something, just let me know. And one of her favorite movies is Memoirs of a Geisha, and I'd never seen it. And I heard lots about it, but this was my first time through it, and I was really impressed. It was, the only criticism I have is that it was a little bit long. For the type of story that it was, I found that 2.5 hours was a bit of a stretch for me. Overall, especially as artists, it's a very, very pretty movie. I'm pretty sure I got this right. It won for best costume design and best cinematography.
Yeah, I think it did. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's true to form. I mean, everything about it is very. Like the devil is in the details, but it's not something that you notice. Like you don't sit there and look at like the embroidery or the patterns on the silk or stuff like that until it's brought to your attention when you're reading about it later. Like, when you see a still image, but when you're watching it, it's just immersive. You know, all of the components do their job and they really kind of suck you in. And I was really surprised to find out that most of it was shot in California. Mm. And I was like, how the hell? I mean, like, I understand that just all the movie magic tricks and stuff like that that people do, but, like, I mean, I really felt that I was watching a foreign film. Like, it did not feel the same as when you watch an American movie that takes, you know, it has a scene or two in China. You know, like, it really felt authentic, especially as a period piece. And I found out later that one of the reasons why the cinematography was so so good is because to get the light right and to get the haziness right, they were wrapping the lights for the set in silk and passing the light through that. And that's it was kind of a cool technique, but also really fitting because, of course, all the kimonos and stuff in the movie are silk. And I just so the whole movie is just silky, for the lack of a better way to describe it. But it, I mean, all the other things hold up. You know, it's really good acting, despite English being the second language for many, if not all, of the actors. They all have very good physical presence. Like they emote with not just their words and stuff like that, because it's I don't want to sound funny here, but true to form, most of the characters in the movie don't say anything unless it's worth saying.
Okay.
So the movie does not depend on dialogue to tell the story. So, you know, you get to see how someone is feeling before they even open their mouth. And I think it's certainly worth checking out. It's an interesting kind of like, it's a love story told in a different way. And it centers around over the Second World War. So there's it's a cool period piece when you think of, like, it's not ancient China, but it's like China from like the 1930s through the 1940s and 50s. Like it's a unique kind of shift. And I highly recommend it. It's on Netflix in Canada right now.
Is it subtitled or?
No, it's not.
Okay.
No, I usually shy away from subtitled movies only because I'm a bit of a slow reader and I find that I spend too much time looking at the text and I miss what's happening. Yeah. There was a time when I was watching a lot of subtitled movies because I was watching some anime and stuff like that for school when I was in animation school, and I got used to it. And anime is a little bit easier. Only because they tend to hang on scenes a little bit longer, but live action stuff I just found too fast. Even like something as much as I love is Pan's Labyrinth, and even when the subtitles of that, like, it's such a lush movie and you want to look at it all the time, it's very hard to kind of look down and read it. I do find that I prefer subtitles on home video, like home theater watching, because usually when they do the DVD release, they put the subtitles in the black bar as opposed to over the screen. And also your eyes don't have as far to go. When you're in the theater, you're looking up and down like 6 feet, you know, but when you're at home, it's just a matter of a couple inches, you know, in terms of your gaze. So it's a little easier at home that way. But
it's funny you should say that about the subtitles, because I remember Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was one of my favorite movies. It still is. I love that movie. But I remember thinking the exact same thing, which is that there's these beautiful, beautiful scenes and action as well. Well, I guess during the action, there's not a lot of talking. But anyway, beautiful scenes. You want to look at the screen all the time, but you're reading. So on the DVD, I noticed that there was an overdub, English overdub. And of course, typically, they're pretty terrible. Like it's not a fun thing to do, is to watch something that's meant to be in Mandarin with an overdub. But I got to tell you guys that if you watch that particular movie, the overdub is one of the best ones I've ever seen, to the point where I wasn't distracted at all by it. And I could finally watch that movie and just really kind of get lost in it, which I think is what you're talking about. Like you don't want to be distracted by reading the subtitles all the time, right?
Cool.
When I first moved to Halifax about 15 years ago, a buddy of mine was doing his Asian studies at St. Mary's, and we used to hang out for a bit, and he had a 13-inch black and white TV. I remember watching Yojimbo on that, as well as I think it was Ran, and these old Kira Kurosawa films, and it's all subtitles. So we're like sitting there having a couple beers trying to watch this big epic films on this like 13-inch screen, right? Anyway, I try to read it, keep up with it. It was really quite funny.
Jeez, anyway. I can see you. What's even funnier for me is just knowing you in person. That, I mean, we're both like 6 feet tall. It's to see you hunkered over a 13-inch television, beer in hand. It's a fun image. Well, Peyton, what about you? What have you been watching lately?
I recently watched the
I love the Comedy Central roasts and just, you know, all the, I don't know if you call it witty banter, but, you know, it's all pretty fun stuff.
The ad lib stuff that they do?
Pardon?
Ad lib?
Yeah, some of it's ad lib, you know, and just the cutting remarks and all that. And, you know, some of my favorite, you know, watch the Shatner one was great and all that. And then the James Franco one was on, on YouTube there. And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Franco, but, you know, some of the other fellas are pretty funny. Anyway, it was probably one of the better roasts. Like Bill Hader was quite funny, and, you know, everybody held their own. And Jonah Hill was pretty good up on stage. So, yeah, it's you know, if you got, you know, you're doing something, you want to throw it on in the background or whatever, listen to it. It's pretty funny. It's not, definitely not safe for work.
They never are.
No, they never, ever are. And, yeah, it's, yeah, it's pretty funny. It's worth checking out. Yeah.
Does Franco have a sense of humor about himself?
Oh, like totally, totally. Yeah, he knows. Like, you know, they kept tearing him a new one around the entire performance at the Oscar a couple of years ago, and talk about him as his work as an artist and as a poet and all these other things. And anyway, they're always, you know, I don't think he takes himself too terribly seriously. Right?
Okay.
I think first and foremost, he's probably a businessman. You know, like he had the. A thing on, I'm not sure it was Kickstarter or, you know, he sold art from an art gallery that only existed in your imagination. Someone actually paid like 10 or 15 grand for a piece of artwork that didn't exist.
Oh my God.
So, you know, he's just a good bullshitter, right?
Can we cash in on that market?
Yeah.
I've got a few pieces laying around that are just in your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So
I've been working on several over the last year, as a matter of fact.
Man, that's cool though. I wanted to check that out. It's funny you mentioned it because I remember seeing it promoted a little bit, and I wanted to check it out.
Yeah, it's funny because Andy Samberg is there, and you know he's sort of a hit and miss kind of guy, and he goes in and he's like really really dry, but then he just keeps going and going and going, and he gets like bluer and bluer, and it's really quite funny. And anyway. So cool. That's about all for me. How about you, sir? Anything on your eyeballs?
Yeah, I've been kind of obsessed recently. Well, it's funny you mentioned Jane Franco because where I saw the promos for that was on the Comedy Network because I've been obsessed with Drunk History lately. Now, have you guys checked that show out at all, Drunk History?
No. I've seen commercials for it, but I haven't seen the show.
Okay. You really got to check it out. Now, basically the gist of it is that it started as like a web series on Funny or Die. It's produced by Derek Waters, and he basically goes to these people. I guess they're kind of friends of his, is my impression. And they're actually drunk, and he sits there and interviews them and gets them to recount moments of history, famous U.S. history. Now, that might not seem funny, I guess, on its own, but what the hilarious part of it is that they have all these things that these people are describing reenacted by famous actors. And when I say famous, like, I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing, some of the actors that were brought in to reenact these scenes, like Jack Black, Zooey Deschanel, Crispin Glover's in one, which is one of my favorite ones.
Oh, my God.
He plays Edison to... I think it's John C. Reilly plays Tesla. And anyway, that's one of the best ones. That's one of the ones you can just watch on Funny or Die at this point. So what happened was that was pretty successful. They only did like, I think around four or five of them. And then suddenly they just weren't being produced. And of course, some people were like, I love these. Why aren't you making more? Well, it turns out he was actually, you know, producing a legit, really, really high production value TV series, which then, you know, was airing on the comedy. Actually, well, of course, it was airing on Comedy Central in the States, and then subsequently for us, Comedy Central the Comedy Network .ca. So, I tried to catch some of them on TV here and there where I could, but you know, I often would resort to just watching them on the web after they had already been sort of after they had already aired. But anyway, what happened was, I just recently discovered this the other day. They had them all available to watch on thecomedynetwork.ca, and then just recently, I think the season ended maybe last week, they pulled all of the episodes. Like, if you go to thecomedynetwork.ca and go to shows and click Drunk History, it redirects you to muchmusic.com. which is like, and then there's a big promo thing there saying this series premieres on September 5th, which is kind of like, what the hell happened there? So I guess essentially what happened was they decided to hand it over to Much Music, and they're just going to replay the whole series on that. They must be owned by the same.
Yeah, it's all Chum. So.
Yeah.
So that's just a weird thing that, like, they, you know, they want to, I guess they'll put them back online on Much Music after they air them again, but it's kind of frustrating. So
I thought part of the CRTC's licensing agreement for Much Music was that everything had to have a musical component to it. So, you know, they used to be able to start, they used to start showing films and TV shows that had some sort of music, you know, maybe like, you know, like a Will Smith movie, because he does music and film. You know, but now is they just show garbage. Not that what they were showing before was great, but, you know, I don't know.
So just without, like, spending too much time on me, the fact that I was baffled by the fact that I wanted to promote and say, like, yeah, go watch them yourselves. Now, I will say this. You know, if you're a resourceful person, there are other ways that you might be able to watch them. The ones that have recently aired, like the season that just aired. I'm not going to condone anything, but you know what I'm saying. Like, people can figure it out. But what I'll say is that it's really it's really worth watching. Like, they are truly hilarious. For me, the true joy is watching these actors lip sync. Because what's happening is that they're, I didn't say that, I guess, but what's happening is that they're acting the scene out, but they're moving their mouths exactly in sync to what the drunk person is saying. And that is what's making, that's what's so hilarious about it. And one of my favorites is from the season they aired, the first season officially. Jen Kirkman is the storyteller, who's, I guess she's like a comedian in her own right, actually. But she's drunk, and she's telling the story of Mary Dyer, who is being portrayed by Winona Ryder in the reenactments. And actually, Michael Cera's there as well. And I'm telling you guys, it's nothing I can really describe. Like, I wouldn't be able to. It's one of those things, like, you have to watch it. But it's just the way that their mouths are moving in sync to these drunk people and the ridiculous stuff that they're saying is so great. So I highly recommend checking it out.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned that stuff about Much Music and, you know, pulling content that was already online is very likely, you know, maybe pulled down off YouTube now, but it could have been found on YouTube earlier if you had the right place to look for it. I caught something this morning that I kind of squirreled away in the back of my brain for tonight, and it is a Kevin Spacey talk edited down to some of his more important points about Netflix versus traditional networks. So I've thrown the link in the chat room, and it's in the show notes here, and I'll put a link in our show notes on the blog when the show goes up tomorrow. But it is just a really, really concise and well-spoken point that kind of encompasses all the things that we've been talking about on the Sizzle Cafe this summer with all the Netflix shows, the Netflix exclusives, how Netflix handles binge watching, and how they are listening to the viewer. And, you know, here you are, Chris, the viewer, saying, I just want to watch these. That's all I want to do. Yep. I will pay for it. I will find a way, you know, to look at them. And if I can't pay for it, and if you pull them away from me, I will find other means. Right. And one of the points that Kevin Spacey makes is that, like, if you give somebody what they want for a nominal price, then not only will they more likely pay for it than pirate it, not that everybody will go that route, but because some people are just like, you know, fuck the man, but, you know, the majority of the public will go and they'll pay for it. But not only that, they'll tell their other friends and they'll start championing your cause. You know, I mean, like, I don't know how many people that I've told about House of Cards and Hemlock Grove since I've watched them. And I mean, like, it's $8 a month.
Yeah.
You know, for 2 13-hour movies. Like, it's incredible the content that you can get for pennies now when you look at it in
advance. You have kids.
Sorry?
Right.
You have kids. Netflix is beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, like, and granted, I'm a little bit of a cartoon collector, but I don't necessarily want to own all 8 seasons of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah.
I like having access to them whenever I feel like watching one, but I don't necessarily want to have boxes and boxes of DVDs.
Yeah, we're just starting to get you into SpongeBob now. It's pretty funny because you watched one the other day and we were both laughing at it. And like one couple points, I was like laughing very loudly at them. And my wife, I look at my wife and she's just sort of like blankly staring at me and staring back at TV like, what? What's going on? she doesn't like Simpsons or many of the other things that I find amusing.
SpongeBob is silly funny. Yeah. It's not necessarily, sometimes it's clever, but most of the time it's just ridiculous, silly fun.
Mm-hmm. I had a terrible realization about The Simpsons the other day, guys, which is...
That there's 25-year-olds on this planet that have never known a world without The Simpsons?
Okay, that actually really furthers my point, Joel, because what I'm about to say is that I realize that how much I quote The Simpsons, and actually... it's to the point now where Julia has decided there needs to be a Simpsons jar that every time it's been to the point where she'll say something where she'll say, is that you saying that or is that a Simpsons quote? Because she wouldn't maybe not necessarily recognize all of them. And then I'll say, it's a Simpsons quote. And she's like, in the jar. Anyway, the point is that here's the scary thought. Okay, so we, probably the three of us, can know The Simpsons fairly well. We grew up with it, perhaps, and can quote it. So cut to years from now, people our age, and we're like, say 30 years from now, and we're there and we're like, oh yeah, quoting The Simpsons. Oh, my cans, my precious antique cans. And then
jerk face, you gotta face like a jerk.
Yeah, and then the 30-year-old at the time hears that, and that would be the equivalent to them of if we heard our parents quoting like "I Love Lucy," so they're gonna look at us and be like, "That is so lame, you guys!" And then they're gonna just turn their jetpack on and fly off into the sky.
Nah, because "I Love Lucy" was over. You know, it was no longer on the air. Simpsons still on the air.
Oh yeah, right, exactly, exactly. But anyway, it's just sort of a realization that it's ingrained in us. But there's gonna come a point where, well, you already said it, Joel. There's 20-something year olds who.
Yeah.
Have I mentioned that we're like I'm in my we're all in our 30s, right? So
yeah, just Joel's almost 40, but yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I'm 50.
Well, anyway. I get lost because people, the crowd that I guess socialize with are usually big Simpsons fans, especially when I was working in animation. That was kind of like the thing. And honest to God, I stopped watching 15 years ago and I never picked it up. It was fun when I was in high school, but after that, the last time I remember sitting down to an episode that was like the new one was in university, because it was a Sunday night thing on campus where we would pile into somebody's room that had a TV, and like 8 or 12 of us would all sit down and watch an episode of The Simpsons. And then The Family Guy started when I was in university, and that was hilarious because it was so like just out there. And we would have a hoot, but like since then I've never gone back to watch them. I've never got pulled back in. I think I tried once or twice and I just felt like it was the same show. Like it hadn't really changed that much.
Yeah, I'm so much older than you guys. I remember watching Ren and Stimpy in university.
Oh wow. Yeah, you are much older than us, aren't you?
Wow.
Yeah. Who's 40 now?
You're 53, right,
Pinky?
Yeah.
Well, it's funny, Joel, you say that too, because I recently just bought seasons 4, 5, and 6 of The Simpsons, because to me, those were all I ever want to have in my life. Those were like my definitive seasons. They were the ones that were produced by Conan O'Brien. I love the animation style the best in that particular zone. It's like they just get out of that sort of really rough around the edges style,
mm-hmm.
and it's into sort of a weird, like there's little exaggerations of the mouth and things like that that are really funny to me, and all the great lines and quotes and stuff, like the monorail episode and all those episodes are in there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the "Hey jerk face, you got a face like a jerk" is a Conan O'Brien line.
Oh, is it?
Oh, Sounds pretty good.
And then they go, and runs away.
Right on. Well, I guess we can march into something that we don't often get to cover on the show, but it looks like we've all had some time to actually read, as luck would have it. And I know I recommended this to you over the weekend, Peyton, but I'm going to go ahead and tell everybody about Planetoid by Ken Gehring. This is a comic series that I was turned on to by Scott Johnson on Comic Dorks, which is a comic podcast on the Frog Pants Network. And it's a gritty-looking kind of sci-fi adventure, kind of a post-apocalyptic Western vibe to it. But the premise and the setup, without spoiling too much, because it's fun to read, you know, through for the first time, is that there's a planet that has a weird magnetic field that shuts down anything that comes near it and pulls in a bunch of space junk, too. So you can imagine the perils, you know, in this kind of neck of the universe. And there's a guy that ends up on this planet, and then he's there for the first time, and he's trying to figure out a way off the planet. And through the first book, you kind of get a little bit of his backstory, where he's from, and what his motivations are going to be to try to get off the planet. And I normally, I'm a picky reader when it comes to writing and art and all that kind of stuff. And I have to say, Gehring both writes, draws, inks, colors, like he does everything. And it is a really high quality product for one person to do all that. And the first issue is free. So if you're interested at all, I picked up on Comixology. You can dive through the first issue for nothing. And the series continues for only $1.99 a piece, whereas most new comics are $2 or $3.99. So it's totally worth checking out. I really enjoyed the iPad. I would imagine it would look even better on a Retina screen. I only have an iPad 2. But there it's very imaginative, and it's totally worth the, you know, 20, 30 minutes of just reading the first issue, just kind of see if it's your cup of tea. I love that so many comics are doing the read the first issue or read the first chunk for nothing, and then decide if you want to pay us a dollar or two an issue from here on in. It's a yeah. great way for people to get their feet wet.
Some comics I still prefer the actual ink stuff, you know. Dead trees.
But, oh, dead trees on paper. Yeah. Me too. There are some things, like I much prefer to read my comic strips in book format, like zits or going over old collections of Calvin and Hobbes. Like I would much rather take an afternoon and sit down at Calvin and Hobbes book than I would get it in my email every day by U-Comics or whoever owns the rights to redistribute them now. Like I much prefer paper for that kind of stuff, but. I've never really been huge into comic books and superheroes and stuff like that. So I find it really difficult, you know, when it's like, well, here's, you know, issue number 53. It's like, well, crap, like, where do I start? Where does it end? Is there even an end? Like, it's something that has become a bit of a stepping stone for me, or a hurdle for me to get into something. However, I did notice that there have been more single runs on Comixology, and Comixology will also like let you know up front, like, this is an 8-issue series, this is a 3-issue series, or there are currently, you know, 6 trades available of this. So if you read the first couple issues and you like it, you can spend $10 for 12 or 14, or not 12, for 6 or 8 issues and save, you know, in the long run, if you know that you want to read big chunks of story, you can do that. And while I also like to support, you know, my local comic shop, it's right there in the palm of my hands, and especially with the free stuff. Like you can also look at it as, you know, like you can read a couple things for free on the iPad, and if you like it, then you know what you're looking for the next time you go into Strange Adventures.
For sure, yeah. And you know, the boys are ordered in for you as well. So it's funny. Like growing up in rural Newfoundland. You know, there was no access to any comics anywhere. And my father used to drive transport trucks. So he was always bringing home comic books from all over the place. So like, I'm like 8 years old reading, you know, Heavy Metal magazine, right? It was awesome.
He obviously didn't read it first. Or if he did, he didn't care.
You know, I'm like, oh, that's cool. And he had like, you know, I think he had the entire run of the original Conan series.
Oh, wow.
Like the Marvel Conans, like, you know. And then he had them all in a 2-cube box and basically flooded, and he had to throw them all out because they all got ruined. But he also had other boxes of comics. So I have a big 2-cube box back home at my mother's place full of, like, old 10-cent
you know, Marvel Toon ones with The Thing and Incredible Hulk and you know, Iron Fist and all those. And it was so much fun to sit down with those piled all over the floor. And those are readers. None of them are in bags, right? And, you know, you read through them. But the worst part was, you know, he would have like a 6-issue run. And then he missed like 3 issues and pick it up again. I'm like, what happened? But I'm looking forward to when my son's older, like saying, okay, now we're going to start your education and sit down and like, here is this book. You need to read this book before you read this book, right? And, you know.
There's something that Strange Adventures is doing here in Dartmouth at their downtown location, and that is grabbing the story runs from older issues. Like, I'm talking like they look like they're probably even from the 80s or early 90s. And for the better part of $13 to $15, you can buy a stack of comics that's like Infinite Crisis, all of it. You know, nice. I mean, we're talking like 3 inches of not trades, but of monthlies that have just all been collected, organized for your reading pleasure. They're probably even stacked in the right order, you know. Nice. So including like crossovers and stuff like that. Like, you just, it's very tempting, you know, when you're like, wow, that's everything. Like, I don't have to worry about missing the story or finding something or realizing that the one I want is actually a $50 collectible or some other crazy stuff. Like, it's really cool what they're doing. I don't know, I get paralyzed with like, well, I've heard all this stuff, which one's good? Like, I don't know. I'd like to get into more. But I mean, when I was into comics, I was 12 or 14. I was buying them from the flea market on Sundays here, and which is just a way to kind of like save the tax sort of thing. And I was reading a lot of like Top Cow stuff. So it was like Cyber Force and Stormwatch.
And you're actually giving away Cyber Force on Comicology.
I'm reading it right now.
Yeah, they relaunched the series. They've redrawn them. They did a Kickstarter to get funding to make them, and they give away the issues.
Yeah, they're really, really cool. I think that might be, the ones that I saw were for sale. I think you're talking about, like, there's a mini-series where they did, like, a reimagining of it.
Okay.
Which is still very compelling. It's still really cool. Yeah. But I just, there's something that I mean, and it's told really, really well, but there's something about comic books where they tend to jump around in time a lot. Like, 1 minute you're looking at the potential future, and then they have to say, you know, they go back and they say, okay, well, that was all what the person was thinking while they were running down the road or something like that. And there are some comics that do it well, and there are some comics that don't. And I like to pride myself as a decent visual storyteller, so when I, you know, was reading the reimagining of the Cyber Force, the first issue, there's a point where I really had to flip back and forth a couple times between a few pages before I could figure out what was going on, because they just didn't quite explain what was happening. It's like, well, wait a minute. Didn't they just die? How are they alive again? Like, it just, and what was happening was like, you were inside someone's vision, and they just really didn't visually communicate to you clearly that this wasn't happening now. This was happening or potentially happening down the line. I mean, I like that they don't smack you in the face with like 6 months earlier or anything like that, like they do in a lot of drama TV shows. But there was a few holes that had me a little bit paralyzed in that kind of stuff. And that's the kind of thing where I don't necessarily mind if it gets a little campy and have to have like that little box that just narrates and says, you know, this is happening meanwhile across the city or some stuff like that. Like, I don't mind that. But the art is fantastic, and it's a grittier kind of reimagining of the Cyber Force characters. I mean, you still recognize them, but they look hard done by. the cybernetic implants are not all 1990s and shiny. There's a lot of muck happening and rejecting implants and stuff like that, but they're worth checking out too. So what have you guys been reading? Sorry, I just realized I totally threw it to both of you at the same time.
Sorry, man.
My bad.
You go ahead, Chris.
Okay. Well, it's funny. You made me now want to talk about comics, but I'm not going to do it because I'm really psyched on this one book that I do want to talk about. But just a quick note about the comic thing is that, I recently have been feeling huge regret for the fact that somewhere along the line over the years, I somehow let slip out of my hands all these great comics that now I'm really, really wanting to get my hands on to reread them, particularly the original Dark Phoenix saga from Marvel. Mm. I had that. It was like a compiled graphic novel and had this great cover art, which now you can't seem to get that version. So I'm going to have to head down to Strange Adventures and see what they might be able to dig up or find or order in or something. But anyways, that's all I'm going to say about comics, even though it's tempting to keep going on it. But this one book that I'm reading right now was actually, it's called Packing for Mars, and it's by Mary Roach. It was recommended to me actually by Joey Camo, who is the writer and co-creator of A Softer World, the webcomic, who I believe is in the chat room still. Yes. He recommended it to me a while ago, and I actually have just been recently rereading it because it's one of those books that you definitely can reread it. It's what it is, basically. Mary Roach has done a couple of different books that are basically hilarious insights into sort of these unexpected things. In this particular case, it's into the space program and the like everything to do with NASA that we never really were privy to as the public, which is what makes it extremely interesting. So basically, I'm going to give like just two examples just to get the point across, but you have to keep in mind that she's interviewing all these people that were affiliated with the space program and so on and so forth, astronauts, people that have been in space and so on and so forth, researchers, but it's the way she writes about it is she's just got, it's a really easy read and it's really enjoyable. She's just very comedic in her writing anyway. But what's even on top of that, even more, kind of gets its hooks into you is these crazy things that she reveals that you just had no idea about. So one great example is, it's the whole premise of the book is sort of going through the history of the space program a little bit and leading up to the fact that they're trying to prep astronauts for the ability to travel to Mars. And so some of what she keeps kind of dealing with is basically these astronauts in these crazy test situations that keep failing. And so it's some of them are just that they'll have astronauts trying to cohabitate in a small, tiny space for months and months and months. And it's just like they're trying to dial it in to make this happen. But what's the one variable that is the problem is they're humans, right? Like you can only be so strong, right? Mentally and physically and stuff like that. But anyway, one of the interesting things to me was that she talks about basically fear of insanity because it started with trains. When they first made trains, they were afraid that people would go insane from going so fast and seeing everything moving by them at such a high rate of speed. So they were like, you know, kind of afraid to put people on the trains initially. And obviously that was, actually back then they thought everything would make you insane, I guess. But anyway, then the next sort of aspect of that came with space travel. So they were afraid that when astronauts got into space and looked back to see the Earth, especially like a trip to the moon, that they would look back and see the Earth and realize how far away they were and just go insane. So they kept trying to figure out ways to like prep and, train them, basically train them out of thinking that way. So anyway, one of the things specifically is it's called Rapture of the Deep, which can happen. So this is a thing with miners where they would go down into the depths of mines and they just feel really peaceful and serene and they just didn't want to come out of there. So they, you know, like there's this weird all-encompassing feeling of I just do not want to leave this space, which is really, really weird. And that applied to space. So here's the little tidbit. The first spacewalk. So the first guy that goes out into space outside of the vessel for the first time, what we didn't know as the public is that they had to spend about 40 minutes trying to convince him to come back into the spacecraft. Because what happened was he just basically got out there and he had never felt that feeling before. And they never showed the public. So in the book, there's a transcript of the dialogue between the guy, his co-pilot in the space shuttle and NASA and him. And it's just like, it shows the names and just everything they're saying. And literally it's stuff like, you know, you got to come back in. Like you have to come back in. And then he's out there and he's like, yeah, yeah, in a minute.
Tell my wife and kids I love them.
yeah, basically, right? Yeah, exactly. But it got to a point where it was crazy, where NASA was like, listen, they're talking to the co-pilot and they're like, listen, if he's not going to come back in, you cannot go out there. You have to cut him loose. So what could have been the end result of the first spacewalk was that he was cut loose into space and dead. Like, that's the kind of stuff that's in the book, is just like mind-blowing insight. They polished everything that was in the news, they polished it, and made it seem like everything's great. You go to space, you have a great time, your super astronauts are like the strongest, coolest people, you know, in the world. Well, no, that's not the case at all. Like, they hid all the puke and all of the problems, and well, except for obviously Apollo, was it 13?
Yeah.
The one that went terribly awry.
Apollo 13, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what makes the book great, is you're getting like this insight into these crazy things that happen through that we were kind of just not privy to.
Sorry, did you say they actually cut that guy loose?
No. They
oh, NASA, they were going,
said,
to.
If okay. You can't convince him to come back in, right, then you're going to have to cut him loose.
Nice.
But they brought him in. Everything was fine. And the public,
did they do any prep work to say, just in case you run into E.T., here's what you do?
I'm not sure about that, but probably they prepped them for any. They thought they were prepping them, but
yeah.
How can you prep for alien encounters, right?
That would be a really funny prank to pull if you're like a really high up person at NASA and you're, you know, putting everybody and prepping everybody for this first venture into space, and you're just kind of giving them a packet of Reese's Pieces, and they're like, what is this for? And you just look at them like, you've seen the movie, right? Oh man, Peyton, what about you, man? What have you been reading?
Oh, not a whole lot lately. Other than I saw some list on my, I got this Flipboard thing on my iPad, and on one of the things they're talking about, like some of the Stranger comics or whatever out there, and one of them they listed was The Punisher Kills the Marvel Universe. So I found it on a Comixology for like $2 or $3, and I picked it up. And it's like, you know, I think it's like 90s or thereabouts. Anyway, but it's funny because it's like one of those what if. Yeah, it's a 1995 one-shot comic written by Garth Ennis. Anyway, the idea is that Punisher's a cop, and instead of the mob killing his family's on a picnic in Central Park, and there's this big superhero event that happens there, and his family gets killed. So he rolls up on the scene, and he's all pissed, so he shoots and kills Cyclops in the face.
Oh my God.
And then they go send him off to jail, and then he escapes. He's actually, some people have him, you know, broken into jail, and these are a bunch of people who are all like super rich, but they've all been damaged by aftermath or collateral damage from superhero events. So they charge him with killing all the superheroes and all the villains. So it's pretty messed up. So it's a 1990s one shot. It's interesting little read.
Sometimes those one shots that they do just because they can are kind of fun.
Yeah. You know, so at one point, you know, he goes over and he kills Dr. Doom and takes all of his weapons and he starts killing everybody off, right? So,
jeez.
Yeah.
It's fun. To see people that are not so married to canon that they can have some fun with stuff. Like, I was recently browsing around on DeviantArt, and there's a character designer there that I noticed. And as an exercise, he was basically doing a smash-up of Marvel and DC. Okay. So it was Captain Krypton, and it was Captain America and Superman combined into one superhero.
Nice.
Spider-Bat. The joking goblin was the Joker and the Goblin smashed together, and I mean, and some of them were fantastic, like Venom and Bane. I was trying to think about the other stuff that Shazam and, oh God, there was one other person.
Shazam and Thor.
Yeah, is Shazam? Because Shazam, it's Captain Marvel is his name.
Yeah,
Captain Marvel and Thor, and it was just called the Thunder God. he couldn't come up with anything, so he just called it the Thunder God. But there's a lot of really clever designs.
Oh yeah, Doc Ock and Mr. Freeze.
Yeah, sweet. Yeah. No, there was some really, really cool stuff in there, and it was nice to see someone that wasn't like, you know, pushing up their glasses going, well, actually, when you draw Wolverine in the 1990s, he's supposed to be blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And it's nice to see some people still having some fun with it. So, you know, Punisher Kills the Marvel Universe sounds like a wild ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never really got into I don't read much Marvel, if at all, and I don't really read, I certainly have never read a Punisher comic, you know, to save my life. I've always been more of the superhero as opposed to the anti-hero.
I think the Punisher was an answer to Dark Knight Returns, with all that anti-hero stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I liked the idea of the Dark Knight Returns, and I remember talking about this, I think, with you over the weekend, Peyton, is that that animated two-part series that DC put out on DVD, which is very well animated and well done as an interpretation of Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns, and the first one was really good, but you learn really quick that Frank Miller is not a big Superman fan.
Yeah.
And he really takes it to places that don't really make sense and don't... It seems after...
I think the Reagan era when it was written in the 80s, you know, it may have been a good, you know.
Maybe it just doesn't hold up. Maybe that's what my problem is.
Yeah. That's why you just mentioned the Dark Knight Returns. I was just reading, that's the Frank Miller one, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I was just reading that last week.
Oh, wow.
I was trying to. I didn't love it, to be honest. The art was just not. It's more about the layout and stuff with all that repeating. There's a lot of repeating TV stuff on each page.
Yeah.
The animated movies is still worth watching, especially because the first part when you've got old Batman coming back. Oh man, like he hurts people. Like, because it's a direct-to-DVD release, it's not on TV, like, they get away with a little bit more. There's broken limbs, and there's a lot of, like, bloody noses and stuff. It's the kind of thing that you kind of wish they were doing in the 90s Batman, you know, television series, but they're doing it now.
Although, actually, they did do a part from The Dark Knight Returns in the 90s, actually. In one episode, I think.
Did they?
They have a bit where he's fighting the main mutant guy. I sort of remember that. Yeah, you can probably find it on YouTube as well. But,
The
part where he's like, you know, this is not a fight. This is an operating table, and I'm a surgeon, and all that stuff.
Yeah, the problem that I have is all of those collected Warner Brothers Batman TV series on DVD. They're ordered in the way that they were produced, not the way that they were aired. So. It's like the first thing on the disc is the Christmas special, which is horrible. And then you've got to try to figure out, well, what's the first one? Like, you look it up online, and then you have to realize that, oh, okay, the nerds have come to my rescue. There's one, which is the order in which they appear on the DVD, which is how they were produced. And then there's the original air date, and then there's a secondary air date where they actually rearrange them into, like, not a chronological order, because they don't really... the first season especially, they're more like one-offs, but they at least arrange it to the point where you're kind of introduced into the world.
You ever see the Clerks cartoons?
Yeah.
Yeah, the first episode they aired was a flashback episode.
Nice.
Which always cracks me up. I was like, all right, then why not?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, really bizarre. Well, I guess we can jump into the Internet Minute here, and this is the section of the show where we just kind of share a couple of quick picks that we've found online and just cannot go without sharing with you listeners. And speaking of comics, I'm gonna stay with the theme. I found it on Twitter, and I don't remember where, so forgive me, you know, person I follow on Twitter that I'm not able to credit, but it's basically Scott Williams. They call it speed inking, but he's not speed inking. He's inking at a regular pace. But there's this trend on YouTube of doing like speed painting or speed inking where they basically, you know, they film themselves working and then they increase the speed. So it's kind of like a time-lapse video. Mm-hmm. The cool thing about this, though, is that on certain sections of the piece that he's working on, they slow it back down to regular speed. So you actually get to see the stroke, the control, the methods that he's using with the brush. The fact that he's so good at kind of makes you want to stab yourself in the eye with a spoon. like it's just, it's a really, really cool thing to see someone who is so practiced and so good with a brush just do everything with this one tool.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I've got pens and markers and brushes and things, and he just does the whole thing, even the tiniest little line with this brush. And, you know, we've talked about it before on the show, when you think about someone like Scotty Young that kind of incorporates some sketchiness into the work, so that if you do have a happy accident, it still works really well. Well, I feel like this, that Williams has got some stuff going on where he's got these little nubs at the end of his lines, and they work somehow. They don't feel like that, because they're not mistakes. They're there intentionally because he repeats the process. But it really gives this weird kind of back and forth between the fact that he's rendering something with light and shadow and depth, but also is not afraid to let people see, yeah, no, it's ink. It's ink on paper. Like, you can still see where I've, you know, moved the brush a little bit sideways here and there. And it just, if you got a few minutes to check it out, it's totally worth it.
Nice.
What about you, Chris? What do you have to share?
Well, I don't know how I stumbled across this, actually. Might have been, I don't know, one of the various social media, right? This guy, Simon Stalenhag. Joel, you and I have been discussing digital painting here and there, mm-hmm. like over the last several weeks or months or whatever. You know, I love, you know, some of the stuff that you and I share with each other too, like some of that stuff is just incredible what they can do with digital painting. There's a particular look and whatnot that they can achieve. But this guy did this cool sort of sci-fi, like almost like subtle sci-fi paintings. Did you post it in the, yeah, okay, yeah, you put the link in there. It's simonstalenhag.se is where you can go and see. And the cool thing is, I found the artwork by way of theverge.com. But if you go to simonstalenhag.se, you get to actually see a little bit more. Like, what he did is he posted detail, like closer up details of a bunch of sections of the paintings. My personal favorite, if you go and look through, is there's one where this kid has, it's the first one on his site. Yeah. He's controlling this giant robot thing towards, he's got like a backpack and a glove, and he's controlling this, almost looks like a, what's the Star Wars?
It looks like an AT, ST.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Towards a police van. And, it's just so awesome looking to me. Like, it's sci-fi, but he does it in sort of inspired by the landscapes, and people of Sweden, you know? So it has this really like, I don't know. Like, you guys might be able to interpret it a little bit better than me, but
yeah, it has a down to earth practical feel to it. It's not, it's more like science fact, you know, like it's less science fiction and more like, yeah, this is just where things could go, you know, like it's still gonna, like, you've got this, there's one further down the page where it looks like it's like a harvester or a tractor of some kind that's hovering over a farm, and then is going to use its, you know, hover pads to probably, you know, thresh some wheat. But the guy standing next to it is still in a pair of coveralls.
It's amazing, yeah.
You
and
know,
the
like,
van. Look at the van. Right?
Yeah, and like the van is still the same. Yeah, it's a, it looks like it's a Mercedes.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, leaning out of it too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, so it has that quality that to me, it's like, yeah. How did you just phrase it?
Well, like science fact, it's very practical. It's not really out there. It's like, not everything is, there are some things that are quite shiny and have like glowing lights on them, but they look more like, you know, power towers or something. They don't look like they're, the average Joe has, you know, a walk or two survey his, you know, the land, or to, you know, hunt, or, you know, I don't know what the kid's doing. The kid looks like he's getting in trouble with the cops, but there's a little mischief happening there. But it's like, but at the same time, it's like, well, what do boys do when they're five and they're on the farm and they have a remote control robot? They get into trouble with the police is what they do.
The brother's like, hey man, you need to stop that.
I'm telling mom.
Yeah. And it's almost like you could reinterpret it as like, you know, what, that's them out in a field with a radio control plane or something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's sort of a similar futuristic interpretation of just some, you know, brothers out, you know, playing around in the field with whatever, right? So, but anyway, I just think the style is very cool.
Lots of movement there, even though it's a landscape, right? With the wind and
Oh yeah.
Yeah, no, and they're not. And he's also not afraid to hide his brush strokes either.
Exactly.
Which is cool.
His color palette's great. Like yesterday, you and was talking about trains with snowplows. So we ended up watching some videos on YouTube, and we found this really funny one of this old, probably train from the 40s, probably still running, from somewhere like, you know, Siberia or something like that. And the color palette is very similar to this green little train trolley car thing that he's got painted there. It's very European, sort of, mm-hmm. you know, old Cold War aesthetic. It's kind of nice. Anyway,
yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah.
Really, really nice stuff.
Right on. Peyton, what about you, sir?
Oh, just a couple odds and sods. One of them is a hologram generator for smartphones and tablets that a guy is putting up on Kickstarter. And
what's next?
It's, you know, it's like, oh, that's neat. And at the same time, you're like, yeah, it's not going to work. But, you know, I guess the idea is that he has four sort of semi-transparent pyramid glass thing. You put your tablet on top of it, and then you have a video playing, and the video is broken into four triangles on your tablet. So when you look down at it from each angle, a different video is playing on the glass. So when you pan around it, it looks like this thing is hovering in the center. Anyway.
Yeah.
So it's kind of neat. You know, it's like one of the first steps forward towards, you know, holograms. Right.
Okay. Yeah. I see what you mean there.
Interesting. So, well, I mean, he's got 19 days to go, and he's halfway to his goal almost.
Yeah. So that's kind of cool, right? He's looking to get $58,000, and anyway, they've got some neat little things there. I can see it being effective for. They also have different displays, so it's not just for your iPad. You also have, you know, other tablet displays, stuff like that. But I can see it being effective in a. Like a trade show or something along those lines.
I was just thinking that. A marketing sort of situation.
Yeah, right.
Whoa, if you scroll down on that Kickstarter page to the one that's the Zed, that's cool. That is really cool. Like you get a really big plane of vision for the hologram there.
Yeah, so it's pretty neat, right?
Mm,
and it shows you on the three sides, and they got a four side, and they got stuff you can download. But you know, if you're good with, you know, 3D programs, you could probably do your own things on there as well, right?
So, yeah. Well, once you know how the mechanics of it all work, you know
prototype stuff on it. But.
If I was to guess without having time to watch the video live, I would say that's probably just, you know, math and reflections.
Yeah.
And how, you know, depending on where you sit, you know, how it looks. It's cool to see that kind of stuff making progress, because you could see this, you know, on a larger scale at a trade show where the pyramid is, you know, 30 feet tall.
Yeah.
And then the projector at the top would be, you know, making things appear in the middle of the pyramid. And yeah, it'd be interesting.
So there's that. And then the last pick I have is just this quick little clip of, you've seen those, like, raptor, like dinosaur costumes that they have kicking around, right?
Yes.
The guy's wearing it anyway. So they've got this part of the walking down the hall and minding his business. All these people come run screaming by who are part of the prank. And then this guy comes around the corner in this full, like, raptor costume. And this guy loses his mind trying to get away.
Oh, yeah.
I did see this.
Yeah, I saw this. The brilliant part is that I guess his legs are painted the exact same color of the wall or something.
Yeah.
Because when he turns, you can't. You can't
and all you're looking at is the face, right? So,
yeah.
And there's another video you can follow afterwards with a young girl and the same sort of thing, and she's like lying on the floor in a ball, and the thing's like nipping at her ankles, and she's just losing her mind crying, right?
Oh no!
Incredible costume, like so simple, but like from a distance, oh my god!
Yeah,
you know, there's a thing in Australia at one of the museums there, and they had all these dinosaurs, same sort of idea. And one was like a T-Rex, and they had a bunch of raptors there. And there's like kids in the museum running for their lives, right? So anyway, you know, I'm sure there's lots of other things on the internet that we could, you know, lose our way in.
Oh man, yeah. That's a good pick though. That had me laughing over my morning coffee one day. I meant to show Jocelyn when she got home, but I forgot. Yeah, that's it's one of those things where you just the misdirection is what sells it.
Yeah.
Crazy. Well, that brings us nicely and neatly to the end of another episode of the Citadel Cafe. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we record live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on joelduggan.com/live. Music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod, and the podcast is, of course, available on demand via iTunes and our website, thecitadelcafe.com. That is also where you will find the show notes, links to all the cool stuff that we've just mentioned, including the books and the comics, because Comixology has, it's very easy to find the links for that kind of stuff. It's like most of the time with books, I'm searching on Amazon for like 3 minutes trying to find the right link to share with people, but Comixology makes it super easy. You can even send people gifts right from the website, which is amazing. If you'd like to send us an email with your favorite comics or your favorite TV shows, you can send one to thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+ with just the show name, The Citadel Cafe. Don't forget, this Friday night is the Gamers Inn. That is going to be at 8:30 p.m. Eastern on amove.tv. If you're a gamer, you can tune in to talk to Jocelyn and Ryan live as they break down their opinions on the latest in gaming news and what they're playing. You can find out more at gamersinpodcast.com or, of course, amove.tv/TGI. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything that I'm up to online at joelduggan.com, including my book, StarCrossed Volume 1. And you can also find me on Twitter and Google+ with just my name. Peyton, where can people find you online?
Online, I got stuff going on at cardboardtrios.com. That's my website. And, you know, Twitter and the other things under Peyton Francis. But, you know, if you're in Halifax, look me up. We'll grab a coffee. How about you, man? Where are we going to find you and your good work there, Chrissy boy?
Twitter is audiovisual boy, all one word. ChristopherHemsworth.com, obviously, for everything, you know, links to everything there, including the social media. And, of course, the comic, which I didn't mention before, but the URL is andthentheydied.com as well. And I want to just interject here that I think it's great that you guys are nominated again this year. Where can people go to vote?
That's right. I completely forgot to mention that.
You fool.
Yeah. The Citadel Cafe last year was runner-up for Reader's Choice Award in The Coast, which is a local weekly newspaper. And this year we are once again nominated for Best Podcast in Halifax. So if you're a fan of the show and you'd like to vote, you can head on over to, I believe it's thecoast.ca. I'm going to have to look this up because the actual link for the survey that you have to fill out in order to vote for people is lengthy. You're looking for the Reader's Choice Award for 2013. I've put it out on Twitter a couple times as well. Hey, Chris to the rescue. Looks like it's in the chat room. Fantastic.
Yeah, and when just to interject here, Joel, that if people just go to thecoast.ca, there's just right in the top right corner, boom, nice big
thing
they can click right there. So
yeah,
funny,
so
last year we didn't even know we were nominated. I thought we won.
No, exactly. I got an email one day saying, "Hey, you guys are runner up." It's like, what? We were in the running. That's cool.
Yeah.
We've been at this for almost 2 years now on the calendar, and it's been a super fun ride. Actually, I was just speaking with the guys from Geeks versus Nerds the other day. We're just trying to orchestrate a crossover where we can pop onto one another's shows. Given, you know, HalCon is coming up and the Coast, you know, Reader's Choice Awards and stuff. Quick shout out to the guys over at Geeks versus Nerds. We've actually had Pig Monkey on the show before. That was,
yeah.
I want to say that was like near Christmas last year, maybe?
Something like that.
It's been a while. Hopefully we'll run into those guys at HalCon and be able to spread the word about Citadel Cafe and Geeks versus Nerds.
So I just want to say thanks to you guys for having me on your show, and also congratulations for being nominated again.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah, very much appreciate it, and thanks
You're
for coming by.
Time,
it will not be the last time.
Thank you.
That's for sure.
I had a great time.
That's for sure. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two. Speaking of last-minute stuff, though, shoehorning it in there, did you guys see that Kevin Spacey talk?
No.
I've seen links, and a bunch of people talking about it. I haven't watched it yet.
It's not long. It's only like 4 or 5 minutes, because they didn't do the whole speech. I'd like to see the whole speech.
Because that'll be an interesting counterpoint to
George Lucas and Spielberg recently was saying that essentially film's dead.
Mm.
And that, like, you know, like Lincoln was really close to being an HBO film because you know, the idea of people seeing it in theaters might not happen. If it wasn't Spielberg, it would have become an HBO film. And they're talking about how, like, you know, down the road, movie ticket prices are going to be like $50 or movie ticket, stuff like that.
Just to kind of keep stuff afloat, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's ridiculous. I'm going to, I just put that in my browser there. I'm going to watch that for sure because I think that's an interesting point that it sounds like he's making. And because you said it kind of in the show, Joel, like, people, like, they're going to get pissed off. Like, you, if you don't give me what I, like, that Drunk History thing, that is ridiculous. Like, you had it online and you took it all down and you're moving it over to Much Music. Eventually, like, people just get pissed off and go download it. Like,
yeah.
And here's the thing. The other people, that are constantly out there are making sure to upload that stuff as torrents because they aren't going to have it. Like, they're just like, I'm going to make sure that people have access to this because that's the way it should be. You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You guys, I think I mentioned this to you, Walter, Joel, but have you seen, the Patton Oswalt Just for Laughs commencement thing a couple years ago?
Told me about it, but I haven't seen it yet. No,
it's worth checking. He opens the festival up with this big like press conference talk sort of thing to all the comedians there and everyone else, and he presents it in the form of two letters. One is to the creatives, and one is to the gatekeepers.
Huh.
And basically, he's saying, you know, to you new and upcoming, you know, creatives, good on you. You know, keep doing the Twitter thing. You know, your YouTube channel's hilarious. Just keep doing what you're doing. And he's talking about these watershed moments where, like, you know, like when all these comedians back in the 80s and 90s, they all honed their 5 minutes to get on Carson. And when Carson gave you a little pat on the back saying, good job, you got your TV show. And that was their career path. But when Carson stopped, everybody, this entire generation of comedians are like, well, then I guess I'm done. And they stopped. And we're sort of in this position now with Twitter. And that, you know, things are changing and all the old ways of making it are all falling apart. And then in this other letter to the gatekeepers, he's like, we don't need you. You know, we'll work with you because we want to work with you and because we like what you've done in the past. And he's talking about things like, you know, Louis C.K. and all that, right? We're checking in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just found it on YouTube. I, again, put in my browser to watch. It's the so it's Patton Oswalt's letter to both sides just for last festival. Yeah. Keynote address.
Yeah. What is it like? 30 minutes?
No. It is 20 minutes.
Cool. So like 10 minutes per letter, probably.
Yeah. And it's funny stuff too, right?
Yeah. Well, the thing about that I admire about most, if not all comedians, whether they show it or not, is that they're all stupid smart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like even if they're acting a fool, like it's calculated and.
And all the guys who are actually all the professionals, all the people doing it, you know, people who have reached a level of success, they've been chasing that for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Louis C.K. is not an overnight sensation. You know, he went 15 years with the same 1 hour bit that sucked.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And then he does a great bit talking at George Carlin's funeral, and he talks about how listening to an NPR interview with George Carlin basically changed the entire trajectory of his career.